Even many of the operations that at first blush seemed likely to signal a new era of goodwill between the CIA and the ISI ended in recriminations and finger-pointing. In January 2010, during Bennett's tenure as CIA station chief, a clandestine American team of CIA officers and special operations troops working in Karachi traced a cell phone to a house in Baldia Town, a slum in the western part of the sprawling city. The CIA did not conduct unilateral operations inside large Pakistani cities, so the Americans notified the ISI about the intelligence. Pakistani troops and policemen launched a surprise raid on the house. Although the CIA didn't know in advance, hiding inside the house was Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, a man considered to be the Afghan Taliban's military commander and the second-in-command to Mullah Muhammad Omar. Only after suspects in the house were arrested and questioned did the CIA learn that Baradar was among the detainees. The ISI took him to a detention facility in an industrial section of Islamabad and refused the CIA access to him. At that point, things got really complicated, said one former CIA officer. Was the entire episode a setup? Rumors had circulated inside Pakistan that Baradar wanted to cut a deal with the Americans and bring the Taliban to the negotiating table in Afghanistan. Had the ISI somehow engineered the entire arrest, feeding intelligence to the CIA so that Baradar could be taken off the street and the nascent peace talks spoiled? Had ISI played the CIA? Months later, senior CIA officials at Langley still couldn't answer those questions. The CIA's strong suspicion that the ISI continued to play a double game with the Afghan Taliban was a constant weight on the spying relationship, and yet there were some joint operations that produced an intelligence windfall. In June 2010, 8 months before the world had heard the name Raymond Davis, the two spy agencies ramped up a surveillance operation monitoring the cell phones of a group of Arabs suspected of giving logistical support to Al-Qaeda leaders hiding in Pakistan. But the operation was only joint up to a point. The CIA did not tell the Pakistanis that one of the cell phone numbers belonged to Abu Ahmed Al-Kuwaiti, the alias of a man whom captured Al-Qaeda operatives had identified to the CIA years earlier as a personal courier for Osama bin Laden. Since first learning about Kuwaiti, the trail to the courier had led down multiple blind alleys, and it wasn't until 2007 that the CIA got a tip from a foreign intelligence service that his real name was Ibrahim Saeed Ahmed. This was hardly an uncommon name in the Muslim world, but the new information allowed the National Security Agency to gradually pinpoint a cell phone number used by the courier and feed it to the CIA for the cell phone monitoring operation. It was that summer in 2010 when a call came into Al-Kuwaiti's tapped cell phone. The caller was a friend of Al-Kuwaiti's, contacting him from a country in the Persian Gulf region, and the American snoops were listening. "We've missed you. Where have you been?" asked the man. Al-Kuwaiti's response was vague but tantalizing. "I'm back with the people I was with before," he said. The coded message seemed to be significant. It suggested that Al-Kuwaiti was again working with Al-Qaeda and possibly even had a direct line to Osama bin Laden. Using geolocation technology to pinpoint where Al-Kuwaiti was using his cell phone, the NSA homed in on an area around Peshawar. That made some sense if Al-Kuwaiti was traveling back and forth to the tribal areas where the bulk of Al-Qaeda's top leadership was thought to be hiding, although by then a small group of analysts inside the CIA suspected that bin Laden may be hiding somewhere else, perhaps even in the settled areas of Pakistan. It was a hunch, informed to some degree by sheer process of elimination, The CIA had spent years focused on the tribal areas without as much as a sliver of new evidence that the Al-Qaeda leader was hiding there. At some point, it made sense to start looking elsewhere. The hunch proved to be right. 2 months after the cell phone call, a Pakistani man working for the CIA spotted Al-Kuwaiti in Peshawar behind the wheel of a white Suzuki Potohar truck with a spare tire attached to the rear gate. He followed Al-Kuwaiti out of the city, but not west into the tribal areas and the wild mountains. Instead, the truck drove more than 120 miles east to a quiet hamlet north of Islamabad that is home to Pakistan's premier military training academy and is a popular haven for retired officers who while away their days hitting golf balls on one of Pakistan's best golf courses. There, in Abbottabad, the Suzuki pulled into a sprawling compound encircled by concrete walls 12 feet high. Rising above the walls were upper floors of a large house, the top floor distinguished from the others because it had only small, opaque slits for windows. The house had neither a phone line nor an internet connection. Whoever lived inside was trying to stay detached from the outside world. In the months that followed, Leon Panetta pushed the agency's counterterrorism center to consider a number of exotic schemes to determine who might be hiding in the house, some of them reminiscent of the period before the agency had a fleet of predators and considered using hot air balloons to spy on bin Laden's training camps in Afghanistan. CTC officers brought a giant telephoto lens into Panetta's office, the largest lens available, and proposed stationing it in the mountains several miles away. A safe house that the CIA had quietly set up not far from the large compound did not have a line-of-sight view into the house, so the telephoto lens was useless from that vantage point. For weeks on end, spy satellites took thousands of photographs of the house during passes over Pakistan, but the eyes in the sky produced no definitive proof that bin Laden was hiding there. The CIA watched and waited for a shred of hard proof that might bring the near-decade-long manhunt to an end. With the CIA pursuing its most promising bin Laden lead since the terrorist leader escaped his lair at Tora Bora in Afghanistan and fled across the border into Pakistan in 2001, it was more than a bit inconvenient that one of its undercover officers was sitting in a jail in Lahore facing a double murder charge. Pakistan's Islamist parties organized street protests and threatened violent riots if Raymond Davis was not tried and eventually hanged for his crimes. American diplomats in Lahore regularly visited Davis, but the Obama administration continued to stonewall Pakistan's government about the nature of Davis's work in the country. And the episode claimed another victim. On February 6th, the grieving widow of one of Davis's victims swallowed a lethal amount of rat poison and was rushed to the hospital in Faisalabad, where doctors pumped her stomach. The woman, Shumaila Fahim, was certain that the United States and Pakistan would quietly broker a deal to release her husband's killer from prison, a view she expressed to her doctors from her hospital bed. "They are already treating my husband's murderer like a VIP in police custody, and I am sure they will let him go because of international pressure," she said. "The man murdered my husband, and I demand justice. I don't care if he is American. He must not be allowed to get away with this." She died shortly afterward and instantly became a martyr for the groups inside Pakistan who had turned the Davis affair into a cause célèbre. The furor over the Davis incident was quickly escalating, threatening to shut down most CIA operations in the country and possibly even derail the intelligence-gathering operation in Abbottabad. But the CIA stood firm and sent top officials to Islamabad who told Ambassador Munter to stick to the strategy. Force the Pakistanis to release Davis and threaten them with dire consequences if they don't comply. dial up the pain, and they will come around. But Munter had decided by then that the CIA's strategy had not worked, and he and several other American officials began devising a new plan. After discussions among White House, State Department, and CIA officials in Washington, Munter approached General Pasha, the ISI chief, and came clean. Davis was with the CIA, he said, and the United States needed to get him out of the country as quickly as possible. Pasha wasn't about to let the Americans off so easily. He was still fuming that Panetta had lied to him, and he was going to let the Americans squirm by letting Davis sit in jail while he considered, on his own timetable, the best way to resolve the situation. More than a week later, Pasha came back to Munter with his response. It was a purely Pakistani solution, one based on an ancient tradition that would allow the matter to be settled outside the unpredictable court system. Pasha had devised the plan with a number of Pakistani officials, including Ambassador Haqqani in Washington. The reckoning for Davis's actions would come in the form of blood money, or diyat, a custom under Sharia law that compensates the families of victims for their dead relatives. The matter would be handled quietly, the CIA would make the secret payments, and Davis would be released from jail. The ISI took over. Pasha ordered ISI operatives in Lahore to meet the families of the three men killed during the January episode and negotiate a settlement. Some of the relatives initially resisted, but the ISI negotiators were not about to let the talks collapse. After weeks of discussions, the parties agreed on a total of 200 million rupees, approximately $2.34 million, to offer forgiveness to the jailed CIA officer. Only a small group of Obama administration officials knew of the talks, and as they dragged on, the clock was ticking toward a ruling by Lahore's High Court about whether Davis would be granted diplomatic immunity. A ruling the CIA expected to go against the United States and worried might set a precedent for future cases in Pakistan. Raymond Davis remained in the dark about all of this. When he arrived for his court appearance on March 16th, he was fully expecting to hear that the trial would proceed and the judge would issue a new court date. He was escorted into the courtroom, his arms handcuffed in front of him, and locked inside an iron cage next to the judge's bench. In the back of the courtroom sat General Pasha, Pakistan's spy master, who took out his cell phone and began sending out a stream of nervous text messages to Ambassador Munter, updating him about the court proceedings. Pasha was one of the most powerful men in Pakistan, and yet the ISI had little control over the mercurial courts in Lahore, and he wasn't entirely sure that things would proceed according to plan. The first part of the hearing went as everyone expected. The judge, saying that the case would go ahead, noted that his ruling on diplomatic immunity would come in a matter of days. Pakistani reporters frantically began filing their stories about how this seemed a blow to the American case and that it appeared that Davis would not be released from jail anytime soon. But then the judge ordered all the reporters out of the courtroom, and from the back, General Pasha watched his secret plan unfold. Through a side entrance, 18 relatives of the three victims walked into the room, and the judge announced that a civil court had switched to a Sharia court. Each of the family members approached Davis, some of them with tears in their eyes or sobbing outright, and announced that he or she forgave him. Pasha sent another text message to Munter. The matter was settled. Davis was a free man. In a Lahore courtroom, the laws of God had trumped the laws of man. The drama had played out entirely in Urdu, and throughout the proceeding, a baffled Raymond Davis sat silently inside the steel cage. It was even more jarring when ISI operatives whisked Davis out of the courthouse through a back entrance and pushed him into a waiting car that sped to the Lahore airport. The move had been choreographed to get Davis out of the country as quick as possible. But American officials, including Munter, waiting for Davis at the airport, began to worry. Davis had, after all, already shot dead two men he believed were threatening him. If he thought he was being taken away to be killed, he might try to make an escape, even try to kill the ISI operatives inside the car. Sure enough, when the car arrived at the airport and pulled up to the plane ready to take Davis out of Pakistan, the CIA operative was in a daze. It appeared to the Americans waiting for him that Davis only realized then that he was safe. Raymond Davis got on the plane and flew west, over the mountains and into Afghanistan, where he was handed over to CIA officers in Kabul. For the first time since late January, he was able to tell his story about the killings in Lahore, his arrest, and his incarceration without the fear of Pakistani spies listening in. He tried to settle back into his life in the United States, but in the end, Raymond Davis couldn't stay out of jail. On October 1, 2011, just 7 months after his abrupt departure from Pakistan, Davis was eyeing a parking spot in front of a bagel shop in Highlands Ranch, Colorado, a suburb of Denver. So was Jeff Mays, a 50-year-old minister who was driving with his wife and two young daughters. When Mays beat Davis to the spot, Davis stopped his car behind Mays's parked vehicle and shouted profanities through his open window. Then he jumped out of his car and confronted Mays, telling the minister that he had been waiting for the parking spot. "Relax," Mays said, "and quit being stupid." Davis struck Mays in the face, knocking him to the pavement. Mays testified that when he stood up from the fall, Davis continued to hit him. Davis was eventually arrested on charges of third-degree assault and disorderly conduct, but the charges were upgraded to felony assault when Mays's injuries turned out to be worse than originally thought. The minister's wife, later recalling the episode, said she had never in her life seen a man so full of rage. The Davis affair had led Langley to order dozens of covert officers out of Pakistan in the hope of lowering the temperature in the CIA-ISI relationship. Ambassador Munter issued a public statement shortly after the bizarre court proceeding, saying he was grateful for the generosity of the families and expressing regret for the entire incident and the suffering it caused. But the secret deal only fanned the anger in Pakistan, and anti-American protests flared in major cities, including Islamabad, Karachi, and Lahore. Demonstrators set tires ablaze, clashed with Pakistani riot police, and brandished placards with slogans such as, "I am Raymond Davis, give me a break, I am just a CIA hitman." He had become a boogeyman in Pakistan, an American assassin lurking in the subconscious of a deeply insecure nation. He was the subject of wild conspiracy theories, and his name was regularly heard at anti-American rallies. After the CIA scaled back operations in Pakistan, one Pakistani newspaper even cited the withdrawal of the secret American army as the reason why there had been a reduction of terrorist violence in Pakistan in recent months. On a steamy summer night the following year, Hafiz Muhammad Saeed, the head of Lashkar-e-Taiba and the reason Raymond Davis and his team had been sent to Lahore in the first place, stood on the back of a flatbed truck and spoke to thousands of cheering supporters less than a mile from Pakistan's parliament building in Islamabad. A $10 million American bounty still hung over Saeed's head, part of a broader squeeze on Lashkar-e-Taiba's finances. But there he was, out in the open and whipping the crowd into a fury with a pledge to rid Pakistan of American slavery. The rally was the culmination of a march from Lahore to Islamabad that Saeed had ordered to protest American involvement in Pakistan. The night before the march reached the capital, 6 Pakistani troops had been killed by gunmen riding motorcycles not far from where the marchers were spending the night, leading to speculation that Saeed had ordered the attack. But Saeed insisted that night that he was not to blame for the deaths. The killers had been foreigners, he told the crowd, a group of assassins with a secret agenda to destabilize Pakistan and steal its nuclear arsenal. With a dramatic flourish, he said he knew exactly who had killed the 6 men. It was the Americans, he shouted to loud approvals. It was Blackwater, and the cheers grew even louder. He saved the biggest applause line for last. It was another Raymond Davis. Chapter 15. The Doctor and the Sheikh. A quote by the CIA station chief in Islamabad. I don't want to be the ambassador. Dr. Shakil Afridi had already been working for the CIA for more than a year when his American handler gave him a new set of instructions. It was January 2011, the month of Raymond Davis's arrest, and the Pakistani surgeon had just gone through the lengthy protocol the CIA had put in place for him to meet his American contact. 2 men would pick him up at a designated spot, sometimes a Shell gas station, sometimes a crowded outdoor market, body search him and order him to lie down in the back seat of their car with a blanket covering him. That day, the car zigzagged through the streets of Islamabad until stopping to let Afridi out. There, an American woman he knew only as Sue was waiting for him in a Toyota Land Cruiser. Sue told the doctor that he should prepare to launch a vaccination campaign aimed at inoculating women between the ages of 15 and 45 against hepatitis B. She instructed that he should begin in 2 towns in Kashmir, Bagh and Muzaffarabad, and in the region of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, focusing on the pastoral garrison town of Abbottabad. The campaign should take 6 months, she said, carried out in 3 phases. Afridi made quick calculations about the cost of the campaign, factoring in the large markup he always included when he was giving his price for a CIA operation. He would need 5.3 million rupees, he told Sue, about $55,000. Afridi, by then, had become comfortable with the Americans, and he knew that the CIA wasn't about to start quibbling over money. He was exactly what the Americans were desperate for, an agent who could move easily through cities and villages in Pakistan without raising the suspicions of either militants or Pakistan's intelligence service. He was the perfect spy, and the Americans paid handsomely for that. Sue was just the latest in a succession of CIA officers who had been assigned to work with Afridi since 2009, when the doctor with a checkered history was first approached by the Americans. Then, in his late 40s, he had risen from humble origins to become Pakistan's top doctor for Khyber Agency in tribal areas, despite being dogged by allegations that he regularly accepted kickbacks from medical suppliers, ordered unnecessary surgical procedures, and sold hospital medicines on the black market. Few doubted his dedication to improving health conditions in one of the world's poorest regions, but Afridi was also a fast talker who enjoyed telling bawdy jokes to female colleagues and was a bit too eager to push the boundaries of medical ethics to make extra money. The allegations against him eventually came to the attention of Mungal Bagh, a former bus driver turned warlord and drug runner in Khyber Agency, who was the leader of an obscure group called Lashkar-e-Islam. Bagh's fighters regularly received medical treatment from Afridi. The warlord summoned Afridi to his house and demanded that the doctor pay a fine of 1 million rupees, about $10,000, for his transgressions. When Afridi refused, Bagh kidnapped him and detained him for a week until he paid. Afridi was attending a medical workshop in Peshawar in November 2009 when, according to an account he later gave to Pakistani investigators, a man approached him claiming to be the Pakistan Country Directive for Save the Children, the international charity. The man, Mike McGrath, took an immediate interest in Afridi's work and invited him to Islamabad so the two could talk further over dinner. Whether or not Afridi suspected there was an ulterior motive is unclear, but when he arrived in the Pakistani capital on the appointed day, he attended a dinner at McGrath's house in a posh section of Islamabad. There, he said, he met a tall blonde woman in her late 30s whom he would later describe as having British looks. She called herself Kate, and she became Dr. Shakil Afridi's first CIA handler. Save the Children has denied that neither McGrath nor any of its employees do any work for the CIA. American officials also dispute that Save the Children was ever used for spying, saying that if the CIA were to use large international charities to help recruit agents, it would put all aid workers at risk of reprisals. Nevertheless, when a Pakistani investigative report of Afridi's work for the CIA and his meeting with McGrath became public in Pakistan, officials in Islamabad moved to shutter all of the group's operations inside the country. What American officials don't dispute, however, is that midway through the last decade, the CIA began sending officers into Pakistan undercover in a number of other professions that might allow the spies to move freely through the country. During the surge of CIA officers into Pakistan beginning in 2005 and 2006, when Art Keller was deployed to the tribal areas, American spies arrived in Pakistan in a desperate search for clues about Osama bin Laden and stretched the normally accepted rules of international spycraft. After the Church Committee revelations of the 1970s, the CIA implemented a policy of not recruiting American journalists, clergy, or Peace Corps volunteers to spy for the agency, all of which had been routine up to that time. But senior CIA leaders said these post-church rules were not cast in stone. Testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee in 1996, CIA Director John Deutsch said there might be instances of extreme threat to the nation when the CIA might need to abandon the policy. Under certain circumstances, Deutsch said, I believe it is unreasonable to foreclose the witting use of any likely source of information. The CIA never restricted itself from recruiting foreign journalists or foreign aid workers, but American officials have long understood the dangers of using humanitarian workers as spies. Still, the CIA would carry out all manner of activities in the years after the September 11 attacks, from making detainees endure near drowning in secret prisons to killing militant suspects with armed drones, using the justification that the operations were necessary to keep the country safe. Expanding the categories of who can be recruited to spy was just another tactic of a CIA in the midst of an enduring war. During the 2 years after Dr. Afridi's first meeting with the tall blonde CIA officer, the Pakistani doctor would conduct a number of public health campaigns as a ruse to gather intelligence on militant activity in the tribal areas. Vaccination campaigns were considered a good front for spying. DNA information could be collected from the needles used on children and analyzed for leads on the whereabouts of Al-Qaeda operatives for whom the CIA already had DNA information. In that time, Afridi conducted half a dozen vaccination campaigns around Khyber Agency, and the CIA paid him 8 million rupees. According to his account, every few months he was passed off to a new CIA handler, from Kate to Tony to Sarah, and finally to Sue, who assumed his case in December 2010. He was given a laptop computer and a secure transmitter to communicate with the CIA, and he was alerted to the Americans trying to reach him when the transmitter sent out a beeping sound. 1 month into the vaccination campaign in Abbottabad, Sue told Dr. Afridi to focus his activities in Balal Town, an upper-middle-class neighborhood not far from the headquarters of Pakistan's premier military academy, the country's equivalent of West Point. The hepatitis B program was already being carried out in a slipshod manner, ignoring established protocols that dictate a careful neighborhood-by-neighborhood strategy for vaccination campaigns. Afridi hadn't even bought enough injections to ensure that everyone in his targeted population of 15 to 45-year-old women received the multiple injections required to be vaccinated. Some local officials had even refused to cooperate with Afridi under the assumption that he didn't have permission for his work. Shahina Mumraiz, a public health officer in Abbottabad, said she was taken aback by Afridi's aggressiveness when he burst into her office in March 2011 wearing a black business suit and telling her the details of his planned vaccination campaign. It was only after urgings from her supervisor that she agreed to cooperate with Afridi. Of course, the details of exactly who in the greater Abbottabad area would be vaccinated were irrelevant to Afridi's CIA handlers. By spring 2011, a small cluster of officers inside the counterterrorism center at Langley and at the CIA station in Islamabad were interested only in Balal Town and, more specifically, the large walled compound on Pathan Street that American spy satellites had spent months watching. Afridi's CIA handlers never told the doctor whom they suspected was hiding in the house. Whether Osama bin Laden and his entourage were living there was still a matter of intense speculation, and American officials hoped that getting inside the house might settle the matter. With the vaccination campaign as a cover, the CIA wanted Afridi to get one of his staff inside the compound and get what American soldiers and spies still didn't have after nearly a decade of frantic searching: hard evidence of where Osama bin Laden was hiding. But neither Afridi nor any member of his staff was able to provide that. On the day Dr. Afridi vaccinated residents of Pathan Street, the only people to refuse the hepatitis B vaccinations lived in the mysterious compound, the ones who rarely ventured beyond the house and burned their trash rather than send it out for collection. Afridi was told that two reclusive brothers from Waziristan, along with their families, occupied the house, and that the men had no interest in meeting anyone from the neighborhood. After investigating further, a female health worker on Afridi's team managed to get the cell phone number of one of the brothers who lived in the house. She called the number using Dr. Afridi's phone and spoke to a man who said he was away from the house and that she should call again in the evening. The vaccination team never got into the compound, and Afridi decided that pressing the matter might arouse suspicions and prompt the people in the compound to alter their procedures or even flee. Having completed the work in Balal Town, Dr. Afridi went to Islamabad with his empty vaccination kits to where Sue and her Toyota Land Cruiser were waiting for him at a designated spot. He told her everything he knew about the people in the compound. He handed her the vaccination kits, and she handed him 5.3 million rupees in cash. From a makeshift base in eastern Afghanistan, four American helicopters lifted off, banked east against a moonless sky, and brought dozens of heavily armed young men into battle in a country where the United States had not declared war. The group of Navy SEALs had prepared for a bloody firefight with fiercely loyal men defending Osama bin Laden, or even with Pakistani troops. A decade of secret American operations inside Pakistan had so frayed relations between two putative allies that a pitched battle between American and Pakistani troops in the middle-class hamlet of Abbottabad was a risk that the Navy SEALs contemplated as they touched down inside bin Laden's walled compound. There had been ominous signs of disaster as the helicopters reached their destination. One of the helicopters got caught in a wind vortex and was forced into a hard landing after its tail clipped the wall of the compound, a snafu with echoes of the failed 1980 mission to rescue the American hostages in Iran. But once the SEALs penetrated the house on Pathan Street with C-4 explosives and made their way up the stairs, Bin Laden's end came swiftly. The Americans saw the Al-Qaeda leader at the top of the stairs on the third floor, peering out of his room, and one of the commandos shot him in the right side of his face. He fell back into his bedroom and lay twitching on the floor in a pool of blood. The SEALs took pictures of Bin Laden's corpse, put it into a body bag, and dragged it down the stairs and out the door. Less than 40 minutes after the helicopters arrived in Abbottabad, history's most expensive and exasperating manhunt had been brought to an end. The SEALs destroyed the downed helicopter to prevent the Pakistanis from gaining access to classified navigation equipment inside, with only the helicopter's severed tail surviving the planned destruction. They piled into the functioning Black Hawk and a Chinook helicopter that had been waiting in reserve. They flew west, back into Afghanistan, carrying Bin Laden and dozens of computer hard drives, cell phones, and thumb drives that had been scattered around the compound. The details of the Bin Laden raid did not trickle out into Pakistan until later that day. As they did, Asad Munir sat mesmerized in front of the television in his living room. He was convinced there was more to the story. The former ISI station chief in Pakistan, the man who spoke reverentially about his days working with the CIA in the months after the September 11 attacks, was certain that the CIA would never carry out a military operation in the middle of his country without the help of Pakistani soldiers or spies. How could they? He recalled thinking. The CIA doesn't have any troops. But that night, the CIA did have troops. In the months before the mission was launched, as spy satellites peering down from space took pictures of the house on Pathan Street and Dr. Afridi and his team tried to get inside the compound, U.S. military and intelligence officials presented the White House with a number of attack options. The option considered least risky, using a B-2 stealth bomber to slip past Pakistani radar and raise the compound, was ruled out because it would have provided the Obama administration no definitive proof that Bin Laden had been killed in the operation. Pakistani authorities would cordon off the area and sift through the rubble, and the only details that the United States would learn would be those that the ISI chose to tell. President Obama instead chose the riskier option, sending the SEALs deep into Pakistan to kill Bin Laden. Besides the obvious perils of such an operation, officials worried about sending American ground troops so far into Pakistan. Until then, the only combat missions the American military had carried out on Pakistani soil had been in the tribal areas. The missions took place within miles of the Afghan border, allowing for a quick escape back into Afghanistan if something went wrong. There was also the question with which American leaders had been grappling for years. Under what authority could the United States send troops into a country with which America was not at war? It was the question that Donald Rumsfeld asked in the days after the September 11 attacks when he looked with envy at the CIA's ability to go to war anywhere around the globe. In the years since, lawyers and policymakers had steadily chipped away at the wall separating the work of soldiers and spies. The rivalries between the Pentagon and CIA during the early part of the decade gave way to a détente and a new arrangement in which special operations troops on combat or spying missions were sheep-dipped, temporarily turned into CIA operatives. So, as President Obama made the final decisions about the Bin Laden operation, a decade of evolution in the way America wages war gave him more options than had existed for previous American presidents. It would be an American military mission carried out by teams of Navy SEALs. but the entire team was sheep-dipped for the mission, put under the CIA's Title 50 authority for launching covert actions. President Obama put CIA Director Leon Panetta in charge of the operation. From the moment that the Black Hawk helicopters took off from the base in Jalalabad, Afghanistan, through the tense minutes when the SEALs moved up the dark staircase in the house on Pathan Street, to the final moments when the helicopters rose into the sky carrying bin Laden's dead body, Panetta relayed updates from the mission to rapt Obama administration officials jammed into the White House Situation Room. The liberal Democratic congressman from California, a man who learned only shortly before arriving at Langley that much of his job would require delivering death sentences to America's enemies around the world, had the controls of the killing machine. As the operation unfolded, Panetta kept one hand in his pocket, fingering a string of rosary beads. The suffocating tension inside the White House Situation Room lifted only after all the SEALs had piled into the helicopters and escaped Pakistani airspace without forcing a confrontation with the Pakistani Air Force. But back in Abbottabad, the wreckage from one of the Black Hawks was still burning, and several dead bodies lay on the floor of the house where the SEALs had done their violent work. Somebody was going to have to tell the Pakistanis what had just happened. The task fell to Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who had been something of a troubleshooter as the United States and Pakistan lurched from one crisis to the next. The son of a Hollywood press agent and a man who from an early age saw the value of cultivating personal relationships, Mullen had developed a close rapport with General Kayani, the former head of the ISI who had become army chief, during endless dinners at Kayani's house in Islamabad. The two men would talk late into the night about Pakistan's precarious security in a region dominated by India, China, and Russia, with Kayani chain-smoking through each dinner course. Mullen had spent the flights to Islamabad reading Freedom at Midnight, the 1975 classic about India's independence from the British Empire and the India-Pakistan partition. One member of Mullen's traveling entourage noticed that, from behind, the two men even looked alike, roughly the same height, same hair color, same slightly rumpled khaki uniform, similar lumbering gait, distinguished only by the cigarette smoke that rose from the Pakistani general. Speaking from a phone outside the Situation Room, Mullen called Kayani and informed him of what had just happened. Kayani already knew the basics. Hours earlier, he had taken a call from one of his aides who told him about vague reports that a helicopter had crashed in Abbottabad. Kayani's first thought was that Pakistan was under attack from India, and he immediately ordered his Air Force commanders to scramble F-16 jets to repel the invasion. But the concerns about an Indian attack soon receded, and by the time Mullen called Kayani, the Pakistani general knew that Americans had been in his country. During a tense phone call, Mullen said that American troops had been in the compound in Abbottabad and had killed bin Laden. There was a downed American helicopter at the scene. Then Mullen raised a subject that Obama officials had been debating since bin Laden's death had been confirmed. Should President Obama make a public announcement that night or wait until the following day? Dawn had already broken in Islamabad, and Kayani told Mullen that President Obama should make an announcement as soon as possible, if only to explain why there was a burning American military helicopter in central Pakistan. After a few more minutes, the conversation was over, and the two men hung up. Kayani, whose position as head of the Pakistani military made him the most powerful figure in the country, was facing the most acute crisis of his long career. Within days, Pakistan's top generals would excoriate him for allowing the United States to violate Pakistani sovereignty, but during the phone call with Mullen, he had struck a conciliatory tone because bin Laden had just been killed less than a mile from Pakistan's premier military academy. Lashing out at Mullen that night, it seemed to Kayani, might feed America's suspicions about Pakistan's government harboring terrorists and lead to a permanent break between the United States and Pakistan. A proud man who had reached the pinnacle of his military career, Kayani faced an unsavory choice. He could either appear complicit in hiding Osama bin Laden or incompetent for being unable to stop the world's most hunted man from taking refuge in the middle of his country. He chose the latter. In truth, any fading embers of productive relations between the United States and Pakistan had largely been extinguished by the time bin Laden was killed. The Raymond Davis episode had poisoned Leon Panetta's relationship with General Pasha, the ISI chief, and the already small number of Obama officials pushing for better relations between Washington and Islamabad dwindled even further. Ambassador Cameron Munter was reporting daily back to Washington about the negative impact of the armed drone campaign, and Admiral Mullen generally agreed with Munter that the CIA seemed to be conducting a war in a vacuum, oblivious to the ramifications that the drone strikes were having on America's relations with Pakistan's government. The CIA had approval from the White House to carry out missile strikes in Pakistan, even when CIA targeters weren't certain about exactly who it was they were killing. Under the rules of so-called signature strikes, decisions about whether to fire missiles from drones could be made based on patterns of activity deemed suspicious. The bar for lethal action had again been lowered. For instance, if a group of young military-aged males were observed moving in and out of a suspected militant training camp and were thought to be carrying weapons, they could be considered legitimate targets. American officials admit it was somewhat difficult to judge a person's age from thousands of feet in the air, and in Pakistan's tribal areas, a military-aged male could be as young as 15 or 16. Using such broad definitions to determine who was a combatant and therefore a legitimate target allowed Obama administration officials to claim that the drone strikes in Pakistan had not killed any civilians. It was something of a trick of logic. In an area of known militant activity, all military-aged males were considered to be enemy fighters. Therefore, anyone who was killed in a drone strike there was categorized as a combatant, unless there was explicit intelligence that posthumously proved him to be innocent. The perils of this approach were laid bare on March 17, 2011, just 2 days after Raymond Davis was released from prison under the blood money arrangement and spirited out of the country. CIA drones attacked a tribal council meeting in the village of Datta Khel in North Waziristan, killing dozens of men. Ambassador Munter and some at the Pentagon thought the timing of the strike was disastrous, and some American officials suspected that the massive strike was the CIA venting its anger about the Davis episode. Munter thought that General Pasha, the ISI chief, had gone out on a limb to help end the Raymond Davis affair, and that the Datta Khel strike could be perceived as a deliberate thumb in the eye. More important, however, many American officials believed that the strike had been botched and that dozens of people died who shouldn't have. Other American officials came to the CIA's defense, saying that the tribal meeting was in fact a meeting of senior militants and therefore a legitimate target. But the drone strike unleashed a furious response in Pakistan. General Kayani issued a rare public statement saying the operation was carried out with complete disregard to human life, and street protests in Lahore, Karachi, and Peshawar forced the temporary closure of American consulates in those cities. Munter wasn't opposed to the drone program, but he believed that the CIA was being reckless and that his position as ambassador was becoming untenable. His relationship with the CIA station chief in Islamabad, already strained because of their disagreements over the handling of the Raymond Davis case, deteriorated even further when Munter demanded that the CIA notify him before each missile strike and give him the chance to call off the operation. During one screaming match between the two men, Munter tried to make sure the station chief knew who was in charge, only to be reminded of who really held the power in Pakistan.
"You're not the ambassador," Munter shouted.
"You're right, and I don't want to be the ambassador," the CIA station chief replied.
This turf battle spread to Washington, and a month after bin Laden was killed, President Obama's top advisers were openly fighting in a National Security Council meeting over who really was in charge in Pakistan. At the June 2011 meeting, Munter, who participated via secure video link, began making his case that he should have veto power over specific drone strikes. Using soccer terminology, he said he should get a red card to scuttle proposed strikes. Leon Panetta cut Munter off mid-sentence, telling him that the CIA had the authority to do what it wanted in Pakistan. It didn't need to get the ambassador's approval for anything.
"I don't work for you," Panetta told Munter, according to several people at the meeting.
But Secretary of State Hillary Clinton came to Munter's defense. She turned to Panetta and told him that he was wrong to assume he could steamroll the ambassador and launch strikes against his approval.
"No, Hillary," Panetta said. "It's you who are flat wrong."
There was a stunned silence, and National Security Advisor Tom Donilon tried to regain control of the meeting by quieting the squabbling aides. In the weeks that followed the meeting, Donilon brokered a compromise of sorts. Munter would be allowed to object to specific drone strikes, but the CIA could still press its case to the White House and get approval for strikes even over the ambassador's objections. The ambassador was given, at best, a yellow card. Obama's CIA had won another battle. In the months that followed, Munter increasingly found himself isolated. Even Admiral Mullen, once the administration's most prominent advocate of maintaining at least barely functional relations with Islamabad, began to take a darker view toward Pakistan after the bin Laden raid. Not only did Mullen have his suspicions that someone senior in the Pakistani military, or ISI, may have been hiding Osama bin Laden, he had also become aware of an astonishing piece of intelligence. American spies had telephone intercepts that seemed to prove that the killing of Syed Salim Shahzad, a Pakistani journalist who had been investigating links between the ISI and Pakistani militant groups, had been ordered by Pakistani spies. Shahzad had been beaten to death and tossed into an irrigation canal 80 miles south of Islamabad. According to classified assessments by American spy agencies, the killing had been an order from the highest ranks of the ISI, from General Ahmad Shuja Pasha himself. Not long afterward, a separate intelligence tip warned that two suspicious fertilizer trucks were navigating the NATO supply routes from Pakistan to Afghanistan. The tip was vague and warned only that the trucks might be used as bombs and driven into Afghanistan for an attack against an American base. U.S. military officials in Afghanistan called General Kayani in Pakistan to alert him, and Kayani promised that the trucks would be stopped before they reached the Afghan border. But the Pakistanis did not act. The truck sat in North Waziristan for 2 months as operatives from the Haqqani network turned them into suicide bombs powerful enough to kill hundreds of people. American intelligence about the location of the trucks remained murky, but Admiral Mullen was certain that, given the ISI's history of contacts with the Haqqanis, Pakistani spies would be able to put a stop to any attack. By September 9, 2011, the trucks were moving toward Afghanistan, and the top American commander in the region, General John Allen, urged General Kayani to stop the trucks during a trip to Islamabad. Kayani told Allen he would make a phone call to prevent any imminent assault, an offer that raised eyebrows because it seemed to indicate a particularly close relationship between the Haqqanis and Pakistan's security apparatus. Then, on the eve of the 10th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon,
one of the trucks pulled up next to the outer wall of a U.S. military base in Wardak province in eastern Afghanistan. The driver detonated the explosives inside the vehicle, and the blast ripped open the wall to the base. The explosion wounded more than 70 American Marines inside the base, and spiraling shrapnel killed an 8-year-old Afghan girl standing half a mile away. The attack infuriated Mullen and convinced him that General Kayani had no sincere interest in curbing his military's ties to militant groups like the Haqqanis. Other top American officials had been convinced of this years earlier, but Mullen had believed that Kayani was a different breed of Pakistani general, a man who saw the ISI's ties to the Taliban, the Haqqani network, and Lashkar-e-Taiba as nothing more than a suicide pact. But the Wardak bombing was, for Mullen, proof that Pakistan was playing a crooked and deadly game. Days after the bombing, and immediately after the Haqqani network launched another brazen attack, this time on the American embassy compound in Kabul, Admiral Mullen went to Capitol Hill to give his final congressional testimony as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He came to deliver a blunt message, one that State Department officials had been unsuccessful in trying to soften in the hours before he appeared before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Pakistani spies were directing the insurgency inside of Afghanistan, Mullen told the congressional panel, and had blood on their hands from the deaths of American troops and Afghan civilians. The Haqqani network, Mullen said, acts as a veritable arm of Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Agency. Even after a tumultuous decade of American relations with Pakistan, no top American official up to that point had made such a direct accusation in public. The statement carried even more power because it came from Admiral Michael Mullen, whom Pakistani officials considered to be one of their few remaining allies in Washington. The generals in Pakistan were stung by Mullen's comments, no one more than his old friend General Ashfaq Pervez Kayani. The relationship was dead. The two men didn't speak again after Mullen's testimony. Each man felt he had been betrayed by the other. Days after Osama bin Laden was killed, Dr. Shakil Afridi received an urgent call from Sue, his CIA handler. The fallout from the American operation was still roiling Pakistan, and Afridi had not heard from anyone in the CIA since the Navy SEAL stormed the house in Abbottabad. As the details of the operation began trickling out, Afridi finally understood why he had been in Abbottabad, why the CIA had asked him to focus his work on Bilal Town, and why there had been so much interest in the house on Pathan Street. Sue told Afridi to come immediately to Islamabad and meet her at one of their regular rendezvous spots. "It's not safe for you to stay in Pakistan," she told the doctor when they met. The ISI was already hunting for anyone who might have helped the Americans find bin Laden, and it was just a matter of time before his work for the CIA was discovered. She told him to get on a bus and head west across the border into Afghanistan. She handed him a telephone number and told him to call the number once he reached the bus station in Kabul. From there, he would receive further instructions. He never went. Afridi assumed that since the CIA had never told him that he was involved in the bin Laden hunt, he would be safe in his own country and not be caught up in the dragnet that Pakistani security services had set up after the Abbottabad raid. It was a gross miscalculation. By the end of May, Dr. Afridi had been arrested by the ISI and imprisoned. After years of tumult between the Central Intelligence Agency and Pakistan's Directorate for Inter-Services Intelligence, after the double dealing by both sides, and after the recriminations when a CIA contractor killed two people in Lahore and drew back the curtain on the new front of America's secret war in Pakistan, the case of Dr. Shakil Afridi showed just how far things had plummeted for the United States and Pakistan. The ISI had arrested a key CIA source, a man who played a role in the effort to track down the world's most wanted terrorist and put him in a jail cell in Peshawar. Of course, no country looks kindly upon one of its citizens when he's caught working for a foreign spy service, but bizarrely, Afridi was not charged with treason nor espionage, nor was he even charged under Pakistani law. Instead, he found himself in a court in Peshawar for violating the obscure British-era frontier crimes regulations that govern Pakistan's tribal areas. Afridi had joined a conspiracy to wage war against the state, the court found, because of his ties to Lashkar-e-Islam, the militant group run by the bus driver cum drug lord who had kidnapped him in 2008. Because Afridi had given medical treatment to Bagh's fighters, and because of what the court described as his love for Mangal Bagh, Dr. Afridi was sentenced to 33 years in prison. When the sentence was handed down, Lashkar-e-Islam issued a public statement vehemently denying any ties with such a shameless man. Afridi was no friend of the group, the statement said, because of his history of overcharging his patients. Chapter 16. Fire from the Sky. A quote by W. George Jameson. Everything is backwards. One morning in late summer 2011, days before he took over as director of the Central Intelligence Agency, General David Petraeus paid a visit to Michael Hayden, the Bush administration's third and final CIA director. The two men had ascended the ranks of the military during the same era, but had chosen very different paths and had never been particularly close. Hayden had been a military intelligence specialist and ran the ultra-secret National Security Agency in the years before he took over at Langley. Petraeus had spent a career in combat units, running the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and leading U.S. Central Command. He had emerged as one of American history's most lauded generals. The men shared a cordial breakfast at Hayden's house, and Hayden offered advice to Petraeus about managing the tribal dynamics at Langley. As Hayden had learned, the case officers and analysts could be devoted, yet prickly, didn't salute smartly, and sometimes had little tolerance for the chain of command. Midway through breakfast, the discussion turned serious, and Hayden offered a warning to Petraeus. The CIA had changed, perhaps permanently, he said, and there was a real danger that the spy agency could turn into no more than a smaller, more secretive version of the Pentagon. Never before has the CIA looked more like the OSS, Hayden said, referring to William Donovan's band of cloak-and-dagger men. After a decade of secret war, Hayden said, manhunting and targeted killing operations were consuming the CIA, and if that continued, the agency might one day be incapable of carrying out what was supposed to be its primary mission, spying. The CIA is not the OSS, Hayden continued. It's the nation's global intelligence service, and you've got to discipline yourself to carve out time to do something else besides counterterrorism.